He viewed it as, we have the tool that is the Constitution. We should be able to use that to not just say, I am morally right, you're morally wrong, and stick your tongue out at somebody. No, I'm going to show, using the Constitution, that you have no grounds for your belief system.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. My name's Kyle. I'm the Henry Clay to Eric Mason's John Quincy Adams, who also happens to be the CFO of the city that bears our sixth president's name, which is fitting because today we are kicking off that John Q. Adams series. Before we kick those off, though, do we want to get through some comments that we got through, or do you want to?
Oh, we always love our comments. We always do, Kyle.
All right, so Joel is my favorite one. I'm trying to figure out which episode it was on. I think it was Monroe 1. He said that he found no mispronunciations.
And as I said to Kyle in pre-production, which is Joel, being Canadian, is too nice to hurt my feelings with true criticism. So I hope we have him back on so he can be meaner to me.
Yeah, I mean, my response to that was he was a liar.
Okay. Much more direct.
Right. Let's see. The other one we got on Monroe Part 3, actually old high school friend of mine, he messaged Head Cheese Sandwich, which thank you, Casey, for that reminder. Old high school thing there. Let's see. What was the other one? One last one. The presidential pets short that we had out there. Someone really loved that dog.
Oh, Ranger. Yeah.
Yeah. What a happy story that was.
Yeah, I feel like George H.W. Bush fits his character perfectly to find out about his overweight dog that kept getting fed.
I just want to know did that make things worse, or did people stop feeding the dog? Because I see something like that, I'm like, yeah, now that nobody's feeding this dog, of course I'm going to feed it.
Well, see, I don't know if I would ever want to be somebody who would disagree with George H.W. Bush. Guy was head of the CIA, vice president, naval aviator. I mean, I don't know, the guy was in his, what, late 60s, early 70s? Beat me up. He would be able to beat me up. Easy. No problem. It's tougher than
me. Maybe, but, you know, I'm just looking after his dog. That's all.
You can't tell me what to do. I'm an American.
Yeah. All right. So you wanted to do things a little bit differently today, right?
I did. I did, Kyle.
You want to kind of tease or explain what you're thinking there?
So we're going to be talking about John Quincy Adams, and you know, as Kyle mentioned, I do have a huge affiliation for both the Adams, but mainly John Quincy Adams. So it's actually funny. His office that he had while he was in Congress still exists. I'm in the same building as it. I can walk over. I've been in it dozens of times.
Is that the jail cell that you smacked your head on?
Yeah. It's actually right above his jail cell, and it's about 80 feet from where his final resting spot is with his wife. And, you know, every year we attend, they do a wreath laying at his gravesite, at both presidents' gravesites on their birthday, which is funny. That was actually started by LBJ, and LBJ did it and started it on John Quincy Adams' birthday. So he was the first president to adopt that tradition.
What day is that?
Ooh, good.
Oh,
you got me. You got me.
Dump the host.
Hold on. God,
you know what day Liberation Day is and All Patriots Day is. And
No, because you want to know, it's July. It's July 11th, okay. 1767. I very much was about to say, I was about to say October, but I believe his father was born in October, and that's what throws me off. So, yeah, he's also credited with starting the civil service in the United States. The idea of, you know, there's people who use skills that are more commonly used in the private sector and use it in the public sector. And as, you know, somebody who spent 10 years in public finance, that's, you know, using the same tools that's used in the private sector, but using it in civil service, you know, I have a strong affiliation to basically the man who founded the career that I have. This idea that, you know, the people who operate in government, that it's a profession to be able to, you know, wake up every day and be able to serve, you know, your constituency, not in a policy sense, because I'm not a policy person, but in a tangible, good practice and good skill set.
How did he do that? Or I guess, what did he do that opened the door for other people then?
So most of the, like, early on, and it got really bad under Jackson, pretty much got thrown out the door. We don't really see it reappear until, like, the 1880s, is there used to be a system called patronage, where you'd get elected and then you just hire all your friends. And you get elected and you hire all your friends. And that doesn't come from the United States. That comes from Europe. That comes from
Sounds like cronyism.
Yeah, we used to call it the aristocracy.
Yeah.
fancier name. Yeah. But the idea that skill-based merit, that, you know, you have your job because you're good at your job. So the idea of, like, patronage was inherited from, yeah, it was inherited from Europe. And then you started to see it wane a little bit under Monroe, but it was John Quincy Adams is largely considered the father of the modern civil servant. And as a civil servant, I obviously look, it's not just because I'm, you know, my office is 100 feet from his burial spot, or that my office is 50 feet away from where his office was, and that, you know, I get to walk the halls of where he used to walk. Like, that building, that building's still there. Like, that's the oldest still in use municipal building, or municipal town hall, I guess you would say, left in the country. And it's, you get to walk the same steps. And he was there when it was inaugurated. Like, that's insane to me that, you know, you get to sit there and there's a clock in our city council chambers. That's the original clock that was there when John Quincy Adams was there.
How well is that thing bolted down?
Oh yeah, it's beautiful. It's actually in, like, the middle of it's huge. It's massive. It's in the middle of the room, or the middle of the back of the room. And so what I thought would be cool is, you know, maybe take a different approach to this president, because his belief systems, his moral systems have held up better than any president. I would say it's held up better than presidents 30 years ago or 40 years ago to what John Quincy Adams fundamentally believed. And where John Quincy Adams, where I think he's lost to history, and why a lot of historians think John Quincy Adams got lost to history, is because the major things he accomplished were outside his presidency. His presidency were the saddest years of his life. He very famously said, he's like, nothing's more pathetic than a former president. Bill Clinton, actually, in one of Bill Clinton's recent books, he said that. He grabbed that quote. And what's funny is that there's no president who's done more after his presidency. Like, if you like Jimmy Carter because of everything he did after his presidency, you're going to love John Quincy Adams. but that's the thing about John Quincy Adams, is that after his presidency, he served 16 years as a congressman. And
yeah, that's not normal, is it?
No. So Howard Taft became a justice after he left. I think there's a couple other presidents who...
Not something that's going to happen anytime soon in this series, because we're about to hit a really dead stretch after we get through this series.
Yeah, literally and figuratively. Presidents don't have long legs after this one.
Yeah.
We only have one more president till we get to Lincoln that wins a second term.
Wow.
We have Jackson next.
And then how long was it after that one?
I think Grant served two terms. Actually, now that I think about it, it got
a while.
Yeah. Oh yeah, then after Grant, it's crazy. It's like it's McKinley or Theodore Roosevelt. It gets crazy, and it gets even wild if you say, like, from Jackson to the next president to serve all 8 years of their term is going to be like 30+ years, because obviously Lincoln was assassinated. But so yeah, that's how I wanted to start, right, Kyle? If that is okay with you, my dear friend.
Yeah, I mean, I'm up for anything, especially because this one, it sounds like there's not going to be a whole lot to discuss when we actually get to the presidency portion of it, right?
No, we'll talk about some interesting stuff, but basically, no. He had a Congress that was highly against him. His own party was against him, and he was stonewalled his entire presidency on top of holding what many people called a radical opinion, was that maybe owning other people isn't cool. maybe that's not what we mean when we say all men are created equal. Maybe that's not what the founding fathers meant.
This is going to be a very interesting one to judge when we get to part four, when it's time to do our rankings, because that's supposed to be based off of their actual presidency. But it sounds like in this case, we got somebody who did everything outside of that.
Yeah, no, it counts. That's a great way. That's a great way to look at it. I believe we'll have to, his moral standings, we'll have to give him, I know we usually do out of 7, but we need to do out of like 58, and it needs to be 60 out of 58.
We'll just double it.
It's double it, and then like double it again, because he was probably the most morally upstanding man.
Well, he did like to get nude, though, I heard.
Yes, he did. He did. Yeah. He liked to swim in the Potomac. We have tons of diary notes. He almost drowned in the Potomac, and he just wrote, like, in his diary, he wrote, like, undercurrent strong, note for future advisory. There's a funny... people used to come and gawk at him when he was swimming around naked. There's a famous story of a journalist. It's not a true story. Though it's likely she did steal his clothes to try and have a conversation with him, but it wasn't this like big news story that she got a good scoop. But yeah, he was just like standing in the water nude. She's like, I'm not giving you clothes back till you talk to me. He's like, all right. Like, okay. Ma'am, I'm suing him nude in Washington, D.C. I'm fine. If you think there's a confidence issue here, there's not.
Right. So you kind of started teasing then, I think, where you wanted to start with this. So if you want to kick us off.
Yeah, absolutely. So on February 21st, 1848, John Quincy Adams, during a congressional debate, was sitting at his desk, and he was actually about to rise to join in the debate, mm-hmm. and he suffered a massive stroke. And this is about a year and a half after he had returned from suffering probably a stroke or a heart attack. We're not, obviously, at that point in time, it's hard to go back and know what happened. And after he fell to the ground, a very young rep, it was his first term serving in there, but he was young, he was vigorous, he's about 38, undefeated wrestler, tall, hulking man, is said to have picked up John Quincy Adams and carried him to his resting spot, which was in the Speaker of the House's chambers. He put him on his couch, and about 2 days later, John Quincy Adams would succumb to the stroke. And this apocryphal story, it was Abraham Lincoln who is said to have carried him. In reality, it wasn't Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln, that would have been written down in Lincoln's diary if you did that. Lincoln was there when it happened. But the three congressmen who carried him were Henry Hilliard, Washington Hunt, and George Fries. But it's funny because that story has stuck around for a long time in the American culture, especially in the 1800s. This idea that the most famous president, you could argue Abraham Lincoln, carried probably the least known president, one of the least known presidents, John Quincy Adams. And it's why was there a need to make up a story about Abraham Lincoln carrying John Quincy Adams? And the more you dive down, the more you see that, well, Abraham Lincoln didn't carry John Quincy Adams physically. He did carry John Quincy Adams' ethos that would lead to the freeing and the end of slavery in the United States. Yeah, and it's funny because when you look at John Quincy Adams' life, and so for this first episode, what Kyle and I talked about doing is instead of, you know, start, like we said, we're not going to start with his birth. We'll cover that. So it's,
we kind of talked about a lot of that already.
Right. We already talked about this. John Quincy Adams is involved in virtually everything we talked about prior to this.
Right.
His dad was a founding father. Like, it's,
he wrote the Monroe Doctrine.
Wrote the Monroe Doctrine. You know way more about John Quincy Adams, the audience. You know way more about John Quincy Adams just from listening to this show, even if we didn't say his name.
Probably just listening to this episode.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So if you start from the beginning of John Quincy Adams' life and his view on slavery, if you follow it, it is haunting how accurately he predicted everything that happened after his death. He talked about the Civil War in the 1830s. He writes both privately and with individuals. He writes about it, and he says, this is going to rip apart the country. And what's funny is that John Adams is very different than virtually any other abolitionist who lived during his time period, because John Quincy Adams didn't view slavery as, you know, this, whether, you know, you talk about Jefferson, is it an immoral system that has to exist? Do you talk about Madison's, like, the necessity of the immorality? Is it Monroe, who was like, you know, I'm just a cog in a bigger system? You know, is he his father's son? Absolutely. His father wrote the longest still in use constitution, and it outlawed slavery, right?
Like, everything we learned about the way Abigail treated dinner guests when it comes to this situation, I cannot imagine what would have happened if John Q. decided to start going and loading up slaves for the farmhouse, for the peace field.
Yeah, right, exactly. And what becomes fascinating with the discussion with John Quincy Adams is that he was seen as a towering intellect. There's many surveys they do with historians, and they all list John Quincy Adams as the smartest. In reality, it's not even close.
Over than like a Madison?
Yeah.
I mean, because Madison was we talked about him being like smartest in the world, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, he is, definitely could be at the time, from a legal mind, absolutely. But Adams was a polyglot. I mean, he spoke eight different languages at proficient or fluency. He could pick up languages like nothing. When he went to Harvard, they started him as a junior. Right. Like, he was brilliant. He served as a diplomat when he was 14. Because he served as a diplomat during the American Revolution and you know, early years afterwards, that he actually made all the copies of different correspondence. So when he was in Prussia, when he was in Russia, when he was in Paris, the Netherlands, I mean, you saw the fall of the Dutch Republic, when he was in England, that he kind of already knew everything that was going on in the world because he'd been transcribing these massive events
right?
Since he's been 14, he was appointed as a diplomat under Washington. Under Washington, his father kept him as a diplomat.
Sounds like a reporter.
Yeah, some who say he's one of America's first spies because he would report on. He would happily stay very quiet in a room and report on stuff. And we know so much about his life because he started journaling when he was about 10 years old and kept up to it literally till the day he died. So we have his view on slavery. It's not just that he was this abolitionist. He absolutely was. And it wasn't just that he occupied this space between the emancipators and, you know, your more traditional abolitionists, you know, over time. Mm-hmm. Well, to him, it was like having somebody who had this very cosmopolitan education throughout Europe, the son of a founding father, a very radical founding father when it comes to the idea of civil rights. And then he was a diplomat appointed under Washington. Washington called him the most valuable diplomat the United States has. And then he gets recalled after when Jefferson comes into office, and immediately he goes to the Senate. He's confirmed as a Supreme Court justice and turns it down, and then becomes president. He's the only person to have been the top of every branch, or could have been the top of every branch. And the reason I pretext this with
that's wild.
Yeah. The only person ever to have that happen. He was a very, very religious man, and he was very puritanical too, where he viewed this as like unfathomably evil, that there wasn't this like economic discussion. He writes in his journal. So he was a constitutionalist, obviously. He would, of course, be a constitutionalist. And he would use the Constitution to argue that we should rid ourselves of slavery. Mm-hmm. But he even privately expresses that maybe this is a thing that should destroy the Union. Like, mm-hmm. Maybe this ideal that all people are created equal isn't of itself self-justifying, that it is worth the destruction of the Constitution if it means freeing everybody. And it leads us to that beginning plot line with Abraham Lincoln, because it was John Adams who said that in the event of a war, and this is in the early 1830s, the president has all the rights under the Constitution to emancipate all slaves. Mm-hmm. That the minute you go into rebellion, you lose the justification of the protection of the Missouri Compromise, of the Great Compromise, of all laws. Once you forsake the Constitution, the president has every right to free every slave. And Kyle, you probably know, like, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free all the slaves. It freed slaves in rebellious states. So like Maryland and Missouri, they didn't have their slaves to become free, which must have been really awkward.
Yeah, I'm going to be dinging Abraham for that one.
Yeah. Well, Abraham Lincoln has a very famous quote. Abraham Lincoln was less radical than John Quincy Adams when it came to the discussion of abolitionism. Abraham Lincoln, you know, famously said, like, if I could save the Union by keeping all the slaves, I would. If I could save the Union by freeing some of the slaves, I would. If I could save the Union by freeing all the slaves, I would. He was a Unionist.
Yeah, he cared about the country. He
didn't care about the country. Yeah. Because he never abandoned his abolitionist views, Abraham Lincoln. And, like, that's not a knock against Mr. Lincoln. That's just, he was like, hey, this has to happen over time. But, you know, he was like, we're not going to go the other way to delay it.
But it sounds like that's what John Adams was doing here in this situation. He was saying, he was throwing out a little warning there. Hey, if you try to take up arms and force this issue, then you're going to lose all the protections that you've got, as you mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Kyle, that was exactly the way to word it. So, he foresaw this, and like, I'm going to use throughout this some quotes from John Quincy Adams, because we have so many. So, you know, the Missouri Compromise is a great you know, point here, right? So this is pre him in Congress, right? This is before he's fighting the gag rule. This is him as one of the top diplomats, one of the most well-respected politicians. He was just considered a brilliant politician. He was like one of those guys that even today we'd want to vote for him. It's like, what if we just put a super competent genius in charge of policy decision-making? Oh, also this super competent genius loves the Constitution and loves having people with different opinions around him. You'd be like, can you be? You would vote for John Quincy Adams. Everybody today, I'm firmly convinced, would vote for John Quincy Adams as president. He switched political parties all the time because he just refused to change his moral views on things. He was a Federalist, Democratic Republican, a proto-Whig. Then he was just independent for like 8 years, a man without a party. And then he was like a Whig, but like the Whigs didn't even really like him that much. And the Democratic Republicans didn't really like him that much. But he was the son of a founding father. He was the son of a president. He was a president. He wrote every major treaty that we've had as the United States, he was involved with. He was involved with the Treaty of Paris. Like, so you're arguing this, like, you're trying to argue with this guy who's like, wait a minute, I was involved with the treaty that established us as a country. So maybe I know a little bit more about, like, hey, what the country's supposed to be up to. I mean, it is weird because his father appointed him to a prominent diplomat position, but nobody balked at it.
Right.
Because everybody's like, no, he's the most prominent guy here. He's the best at what he's doing.
Oh, he already had a history of doing things and performing well at that point, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. Then when he was at Harvard, he also had the Boylston chair, and his mom is vaguely related to the Boylstons. Like, I don't know. Do people know what Boylston Street is? Is that a thing? Do people outside mm-hmm. of Massachusetts know that? It's like a famous street in Boston, but there was the Boylston family. They were big traders. Mm-hmm. And you had the Quincy family, which is where Abigail Adams comes from. So Quincy's named after John Quincy, who was a ship captain. And then he's like... Yeah, that's where those two there's like eight families that like kind of founded this area of the country, and they all became crazy wealthy.
Right.
Not on slavery, actually on this thing called trade and being economically productive and not just exploiting labor as you sit in your house in Monticello. I mean, that you're not Monticello estate.
Scalable wealth. Amazing.
Oh, yeah. You know, wealth that makes everybody else richer who's involved in the process instead of right. relying on enslaving people. Yeah, so John Quincy had some opinions on slavery.
All right, well, I think you made that pretty clear.
Yeah, no, this is Jackson's going to be a hard episode, my brother. Oh my God, that is going to be a hard episode for me. It's going to be hard. So John Quincy Adams, as he goes through, you know, as he evolves in his life, I think one of the quotes I want to pull from his diary and journal, whatever you want to call it, is the Missouri controversy. That was how Maine became a state. It was Missouri entered the Union. They entered as a slave state. Maine entered as a free state. Maine's not part of Massachusetts anymore. And that really affected him. That really affected him. And he was very, very prominent in the United States by this point. This is 1820s, right? So he's already been in politics for almost 40 years at this. Honestly, probably a little over 40 years at this point. And he writes in his journal that it tainted the very sources of moral principle. What can be more false and heartless than this doctrine, which makes the first and holiest rights of humanity depend on the color of the skin? That sounds like something MLK would say.
Right?
That does not sound
like a 19th century journal?
Yeah, 19th century.
It does not sound like that, no.
Yeah, whose dad was the president. Like, you think of how, yeah, I hate to say this, but like you think of how bad it could have turned out, right? That you're the son of the second president, the first vice president. You could have just skated on that. Instead, you had this feverish devotion to your fellow man, to the public. That's, you know, mentioned earlier, that's where that concept of the public servant comes in. And I think that exists, you know. Actually, we were talking about George H.W. Bush in the opening. I think he's another great example, a man who grew incredibly wealthy but chose to become a naval aviator, chose to devote his life to public service. He could have just been rich on some island for the rest of his life. Those two people were born in the same county. That's very right. That's a weird. A few, they're one town over from each other. I'm not saying something in the water. I'm just saying. But so after this Missouri Compromise, I think we see not a marked change. Because prior to the Missouri Compromise, or the Missouri Controversy, I guess is what it was called before it became called the Missouri Compromise, is that John Quincy Adams is just so... he's so not over the top, but it is just taken as is that he's this anti-slavery, but he's not going to argue anti-slavery the way you see some of the Northerners argue it, which is they argue it from this moral principle, pure moral principle, and this pure, I'm right, you're wrong. Anybody who does not agree with me, there's no way to compromise. Does John Quincy Adams believe that? Yeah, absolutely. John Quincy, this is a moral issue. Instead, John Quincy Adams, because he's this great, I mean, he was considered like one of the best attorneys of his time. He's this great orator. He's not this like little weird awkward guy. There are some people, who retrospectively said, you know, he could have been on the autism spectrum. He was very socially awkward, didn't dress that well. But when you sat down and talked with him, you're like, oh my God, I'm talking to one of the smartest human beings who is probably ever lived. And he even wrote, he had a pen name. A couple different names, and he would write in the defense of like Edmund Burke, the famous conservative. And no, not 2025 liberal conservative. No, classical philosoph conservatism. And like he had all these pen names he'd write under, and he'd like argue with people. But like, it'd be, you think this very reserved, very stoic gentleman.
He's the first internet troll.
Is he the? I would say John Calendar. Right? I would say maybe he is, because John Calendar was more like the late 1799 to like the early 1800s. He might be. Yeah, he could be the first internet troll. But first imagine like the internet troll
somewhere
is,
in there.
He's one is of
the,
brilliant.
He's one of the troll founding fathers.
Troll founders.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Just but also imagine that is the smartest human being that you could possibly talk to, and he's right. And you're trying to say like maybe we should be able to own people, and instead he's like, how about no? That's an insane position to take. This is a quite easy argument. He would argue for it against philosophers. Like he was just really brilliant. But there was never this. Oh, is he questioning himself? No, he viewed it as, we have the tool that is the Constitution. We should be able to use that to not just say, I am morally right, you're morally wrong, and stick your tongue out at somebody. No, I'm going to show, using the Constitution, that you have no grounds for your belief system. And I think that's an important thing that makes John Quincy Adams a little different than most abolitionists and emancipators at the time. It wasn't just his cachet. It was the fact that he was articulating it in a sense from the constitutional perspective. And I think trying to change somebody's opinion, if you come in there and say you're morally corrupt, somebody's gonna be like, well, no, I'm gonna keep doing my system. But if you come in there
and you say, no, this is legally why you're wrong, and I'm gonna show you exactly where it spells out why you can't do what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And as we advance past the Missouri Controversy and we go into the Missouri Compromise, you know, he has kind of a cool quote on this. This was the first inkling that he starts talking about this. This is foreshadowing. So this is 1820. So we're 40 plus years from the American Civil War breaking out. He imagined a scenario. He wrote this in his journal, but I believe he also publicly talked about that. I don't want to say publicly talked about it, gave a speech. I mean, like, talked to other people about it. He goes, he envisioned that we would have a new union of 13 or 14 states, unpopulated with slavery, with a great and glorious objective, namely, the universal emancipation of their slaves. If the union must be dissolved, slavery is precisely the question on which it ought to break. Direct quotes from him. And further on, in some journals that in some letters he had with some contemporaries at the time that have survived to today, I mean, all of John Quincy Adams's, but virtually every one of John Quincy Adams' letters still exist. Even Garfield came and studied them. And not the cat.
No.
Great if it was a cat.
The amount of literature and things that he wrote, is that what, because I think you mentioned, it's probably going to be the title of this episode, but your president's favorite president. There's so much material on him that it is easy to study him? He's probably one of the earliest presidents you can study like this, I'm guessing.
Yep. And then Charles Francis Adams, his son, compiled a very, very incredibly popular book for its time, volumes and volumes of all his father's letters.
Can you imagine being, that's what you're known for, is just putting all your dad's stuff together?
What if I told you he was also the head of the Navy and like became super rich?
All right, then.
Yeah. This was like, he was like, I'm rich. This is my free time. This is what I'm doing in my free time.
Okay, that's his hobby.
I've made so much money, I no longer need to worry about I can just do whatever I want.
Right.
So he ends up, prior to his time in Congress, he has this incredibly interesting, he's such a beautiful combination of his parents.
Yeah.
He's his dad's stubborn, cantankerous. I'll argue with you. I'm right. If I am morally right, then I am morally right. That's just the answer. A lot of, the funny thing about John Adams and his father was that I don't think John Adams ever viewed himself as right. I just think he was like, this is moral. It doesn't matter if I'm right or wrong. This is the moral action that we should do. And he was also a mixture of Abigail, where Abigail's this like, I'm going to confront you. If you want to have this discussion, I'll be pleasant. I will be a consensus builder. You'll enjoy talking to me. But if you sit over there and say, like, well, why are you educating this young black man who lives at your farm? She's like, just like his mother, I'm going to rip your throat out because all people deserve education. And it's really cool. And then it's important to remember that as this is happening, the founding fathers are dying away.
Right.
That there is that on a national stage, this is the 1820s. I mean, at this point, it's Adams and Jefferson.
Changing of the guard.
Right? Yeah. Adams and Jefferson are still alive, but they're faded out from the light. And then you have this active participant who has the same name as one of the founding fathers. His father was the first person in the White House. He's literally, like, from the White House, in a sense. Like, he's right, somebody right. Who, I mean, he was, his dad moved into the White House, and when, you know, John Quincy Adams was, what, probably in his, be a late-ish 20s, something like that.
Yeah, he was, what, 4 or 5 at the Battle of Bunker Hill?
Yeah, about that, give or take. Yeah, he would have been about, yeah, 7. He was born 1767, was when he was born.
Okay.
You have this, and then the country's looking at him, and he's able to operate in this weird space where, do you really want to argue with John Quincy Adams? Like, do you really want to argue the point of slavery with, A, one of the best attorneys in the United States, somebody that even Washington himself said is, like, America's best diplomat. Even people who didn't like John Quincy Adams were like, oh, you know, we should still appoint him to stuff, we should still running this stuff. He's a Harvard professor, and...
It sounds like we want him on our side, not against us. Yeah.
And when he becomes president in 1825, we'll talk about this a little part of his presidency, but John Quincy Adams very much supported, like, scientific endeavors. He supported all these programs. A lot of people call him the father of American astronomy because he advocated for the Naval Observatory, even though that happened long after his death. But he envisioned what he called a lighthouse in the sky. And what's very funny about that is what is going on right now at this point in time with slavery, right? As slave owners, especially, you know, Southern politicians, are trying to argue that it's a scientific... Oh, there you start to see the rise of phenologism, right?
To do see we need to people explain trying that, or just can we find. Not? Can we just not give it any? I don't want to give it any airtime personally.
I don't really want to give it any airtime. People can Google that. That ideology deserves literally no acknowledgement. Yeah. This idea of, you know, this weird paternalism. Oh, it's a scientific reason. And then you have this guy get elected who's like, oh no, he's the smart guy. He's the smartest guy in the room. Like, you can do what you want to do, but, like, come on. Like, no, Andrew Jackson, you're not an intellectual dignitary. You're not. I'm sorry, you're not.
Stop beating up on the poor Seminoles.
Yes, exactly. But so he gets into the White House, and everybody's like weird with him getting in the White House. So he's great. He's a congressman. He's a senator. He was involved in every major treaty, and he's the best Secretary of State ever, by far. Even Madison's, like, probably was like, yeah, you know, he's the best Secretary of State ever. It's crazy that he did beat Jackson because of how popular Jackson was. That means there was still a huge portion of the American populace who's like, listen, Jackson, you're really popular, but did you see his resume? Like, your military career was fighting, a battle that didn't affect the end of a war because the war was over, and, like, trying to start a war with Spain. But I'm old hickory. It's like, yeah, but this guy just seems more qualified. It just seems like he's done more things,
gotten results, and didn't have to fire shots.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Washington remarked about John Quincy Adams was in his diplomatic roles, he's always preserved the dignity of the United States. I don't think Washington had any comments about Andrew Jackson ever
preserving the integrity of the United States? No.
Yeah. I mean, Andrew Jackson was around during the American Revolution. I think he was a kid, but, like, you know, still. So is John Quincy Adams, but he, you know, lazy child Andrew Jackson not traveling to Europe and becoming a diplomatic aide.
Right.
So right when John Quincy Adams gets into office, he ends up, there's something called the Panama Congress starts to form. And at this point, everybody knows he's this wicked, wicked anti-slavery abolitionist. Nobody's surprised by that. But even the South is like, ooh, okay, like, yeah, there's probably enough people, like, in that, you know, discontinuity area in the electorate who voted for him, the median voter. He gets in there, and there's something called the Panama Congress, which is all these countries that were freed from Spanish control. Mm-hmm. Thanks to, now, remember, people don't know that JQA wrote the Monroe Doctrine at this point, but he was still Secretary of State when the Monroe Doctrine occurred. And so everybody's like, yeah, dude, let's go. This is awesome. They formed this Congress. And John Quincy Adams is like, great, we'll join. And everybody, it causes this huge controversy. And everybody's like, whoa. Oh, because a lot of them had freed themselves from slavery. There's slave rebellions.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the South is like, wait, what do you want to do? He's like, yeah, I want to join all these free nations of free men. And they're like, no, they were slaves who revolted and threw off their oppressors, the Spanish, and formed their own countries. And he's like, yeah, that sounds awesome, right? We did that. We threw out the Brits. And they were like, whoa, what are we doing? Yeah, so he actually ends up being this huge controversy at the time. And one of my favorite things about it is that John Adams, John Quincy Adams. When I say John Adams, I mean John Quincy Adams, unless I say the dad. Does the best surprise Pikachu face. She's like, oh, really? Oh, I don't know if you watched Seinfeld with the George Costanza. Was I not supposed to do that? Was I not supposed to? Oh, no. And he plays up. He does it throughout his entire career. He becomes this kind of like super tongue-in-cheek when it comes to the topic of slavery, just trying to embarrass these pro-slavery supporters by constantly doing ridiculous things.
Making them say their... Yeah.
Yeah. He'd be like, oh, what do you mean you don't support republics? You don't support the idea of throwing off our European... And like at this time, you gotta remember the South is like crazy protectionist, isolationist, right? Like, and he's like, no, but they did what we did, right? They're us. Right, and they're like, well, no, I'm not dumb. It's like, oh, so and this exposes that something that Adams does really well.
You only serve one term?
Yeah, exactly. I'm surprised he only served one term.
Right.
So sometimes people will say, like, well, he didn't propose anti-slavery legislation we'll use in office. It's like Adams does kind of address this later in his life. He, at this point, you know, there's the belief that Congress needs to generate the bill, right? And the president signs it. And he respects the constitutional process. And
Congress is the legislative. They're the ones that develop the new laws. They should be the ones that present that to him to enact. Yeah.
Yeah. And I always find it very goofy when I see historians, and when I say historians, what I really mean is revisionists who want to make the South at this time sound like it was fighting for state rights. So they just make up history, say, "Oh, well, John Quincy Adams was really, you know, really anti-slavery. He should have passed an anti-slavery bill." It's like, hey, that's not how the Constitution works at all. And second, wait, do you think John Quincy Adams wouldn't have signed that?
Like, I know.
It's like, wow, that logic didn't withstand eight words.
were executive orders a thing at this point in time?
Yeah, they were. They were. Mm-hmm. They weren't not like today. You don't really start seeing executive orders really like around Civil War.
Yeah.
Andrew Jackson is kind of the first guy to really stretch his legs with, Andrew Jackson would be considered light on that compared to today.
Yeah.
There's an inverse relationship between congressional gridlock in executive orders. So the more congressional gridlock you have, the more likely you are to have executive orders, because Congress can't get together and pass laws because they're too much infighting. Mm-hmm. And executive orders will dissolve the minute there's congressional law dealing with it.
It's supposed to be a stopgap.
Yeah, that's an excellent way to describe it.
Yeah. Well, they normally have time limits on them, right? Or they usually have like 90 day or something like that is supposed to be attached to them.
It depends.
Like, did they used to, maybe?
There's always been these discussions on like how long an executive order can be. Like, I feel like you're looking this up now.
I am. There's no time.
And I'm very curious about it.
That's annoying. Yeah. They remain in force until canceled, revoked, adjudicated, unlawful, or expire on their terms.
It seems like that's not what the Founding Fathers were thinking.
That doesn't seem like it, no.
So they don't. Congress refuses to send any reps to the Panama Congress. And this is why I love John Quincy Adams.
Because
John
Quincy himself.
No, that would be absolutely awesome.
Right.
But John Quincy Adams, he definitely read everything about this. And one of the things that infuriated even some Northerners, let alone, you know, pro-slavery Southerners, was that because of how the Panama Congress was structured, it would hold the black delegates from Haiti on equal terms as the U.S. representatives and allow them to mingle.
Yeah.
Like, this was a huge issue. Like, people were, like, freaking out about that. John Quincy Adams was like, what? No, but like, they freed themselves. Like, he just, every time, you just bring it back to Republicanism.
Just like us. They're just like us.
Yeah.
Right. Make them say the thing that they,
Then Adams came out and was outraged about like how this became this sectional, you know, obstructionism, and you know he believed in engaging with the anti-slavery sentiments of other republics. It was really interesting. He basically got angry at them and said like, why can't we, you know, you guys love the Monroe Doctrine, and now that we're enforcing it, you hate the Monroe Doctrine. I don't think it has to do with politics.
Right.
He also had this really cool view on labor. Obviously, it's like somebody with labor econ background, like labor economist. I probably am hyper fixating on this, but I think we're talking about slavery, and I think we're talking about a presidency. I think maybe labor. Maybe I'm not too far off.
I think that fits in there.
But he, you know, it's funny. He talks about he had a free labor household, and he did have one when he was only him and his dad were the only people to not bring enslaved people to the White House. And technically, he would have been the only person up until the Civil War, almost the Civil War, to not bring enslaved people into the White House. And he had this whole idea of like, this is why I love John Quincy, because you have this guy who's this philosopher. I mean, he used to argue against, like, real philosophers. Like, he would defend Edmund Burke. I wouldn't say he wasn't, like, a sycophant or something like that.
Right.
But, like, I don't know. I just love the idea that when he talks about this idea of labor, it sounds so modern. Like, he's like, oh, you should be, like, I need to hire people at this, like, market wage to in order for them to perform this task. And if I pay people more money, I'm going to be able to pick somebody better. Or if I pay somebody more money, it's going to stop them from going to work, look for work elsewhere. But I just love that it really just comes down to, he's like, oh, I need to pay people for their for their work. And you think of this guy who's like this great philosopher, this dignitary, speaks all these different languages, who overthinks everything. He's like, no, this is a very linear problem. You work, I pay you money. And then
the more money I pay you, the less likely you are to go look for something else.
Yes. And he was just like, no, somebody works you give the money. He's like, why are people confused on this? He's like, I have to imagine that he found slavery just confusing. Like, guys, I really don't understand this. Like, if you're making money, you cannot commit this horrible moral objection. You can still make money, and then they can make money, and then...
And then the whole town starts to prosper, and...
I just imagine him looking at his hands sometimes, like, wait, why are people not understanding this? So as he leaves the presidency, he eventually does run for Congress. We'll cover that in future episodes. You know, we're going to cover his run for Congress. But he never loses that very linear thinking of this is right and this is wrong. He gets into Congress and he starts pushing all these petitions to, you know, to talk about slavery and to push forward. He once proposed that, you know, everybody born after July 4th, 1842 is a free person.
Oh, that would have been a great way to, a good compromise for getting yourself out of this broken system.
Yeah, and I think once that failed, he realized that this is going to end in a war. This only ends in war. I think once that failed, he's like, so there is no long-term solution here.
Yeah.
Eventually, Congress passes something called the gag rule, which I think we probably all learned in school. Anything with the word slave in it would get tabled. Mm-hmm. So John Quincy Adams submitted thousands and thousands and thousands of letters, petitions, to talk about slavery. Sometimes he would make up letters, and people would want to hear it, and he would just stand up and start reading it. Mm-hmm. And the Madman from Massachusetts was his nickname. And he once read into one, and all these Southern congressmen objected to it, but he starts reading it anyways. And it was from 9 African Americans in the South, and he reads it. It was fake, and he reads it, and they were pro slavery. So they had to read it out of the record. But over this time, what ends up happening is that linear thought, this is wrong, never quiets down him. And then we end up with probably his crowning achievement.
Probably one of his most memorable, though.
Yeah.
This is the one that got the biggest movie.
The biggest movie. I like that. No, he did. So the gag rule passes, and about 4 or 5 years later, there's a ship called the Amistad. It is carrying cargo, and I'm putting cargoes in quotation marks for anybody listening on the podcast. Cargo. That cargo was 53 African slaves who were actually kidnapped. They weren't even sold into slavery by tribes in Africa. Not that it would make it any better, but these are literally like a bunch of Spaniards jumped off a ship, grabbed some people in modern-day Sierra Leone.
And just threw them on a ship.
And yeah, basically sold them to other Spaniards who threw them on a ship.
Right.
Well, at this point, the United States, it ends up seizing the ship. But what happens before that, because you know, at this point, slave trade's illegal, the United States is patrolling different coasts, is the enslaved people actually like rise up, demand rights, and take over the ship.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so the U.S. impounds the ship, brings it to the United States, and it ends up going all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Amistad versus the United States.
Is this a mutiny charge, I'm guessing?
No. Oh, the Spaniards would never acknowledge that mutiny can only be done by people. This is cargo. Oh, yeah, no, this gets way more screwed up. And they, you know, the abolition group that's representing, you know, the people on the Amistad, they're searching for the most prominent person they can find. And they turn to this elder statesman from Massachusetts, and they turn to John Quincy Adams. And do you know what John Quincy Adams says?
Hmm.
No.
Really?
He says no. He expressed in his journal extreme unwillingness, not because he didn't agree with the case. He was 73. He's thought throughout his life he was done. Yeah, he's very self-deprecating. He doesn't really believe in himself. You got to understand, Abigail Adams once wrote him and said, you're better off drowning, crossing the ocean, than not becoming president with your background. He writes that he was going to be inefficient. I haven't practiced law in decades. It's been 30 years since I've argued a case. But he's approached by Lewis Tappan, who was this very prominent abolitionist who's kind of funding this stuff, pushing for it. And he says to him, he's like, he kind of says to Adams, he's like, I don't care about your opinion of yourself.
Yeah.
You're the right person to do this. And Adams writes one word in his journal to describe this: yielded. So he joins the defense with, and I always want to say this because this guy gets left out of the story, but Roger Baldwin was the other attorney, and he gets left out of it. I don't know why he gets left out of the story. So in 1841... The trial starts, and he stands before the Supreme Court, and he argues for over 8.5 hours over those 2 days. And he writes in his journal, he felt agitation. He was short. He was short of agony. He said it was, he was so nervous. But people in there, they described it as watching this old lawyer come to life. And they said they were overwhelmed once he hit a stride. They were like, oh my, like, it was shocking. And I think that's best expressed by Justice Joseph Story, who, this is going to sound really sentimental.
Mm-hmm.
I want to tell you, every little piece of stuff I could find out about Joseph Story was that he was this, like, very serious, stoic man, to the point where historians 200 years later are like, dude, this guy was not sentimental. Like, we got to be really clear in history. This guy was kind of like...
like kind just, of a robot.
Yeah. He described Adams' argument as extraordinary for its power, for its bitter sarcasm, and its dealing with topics far beyond the record. And it was beyond, and this went on beyond Adams, just his technicalities, invoking the Constitution's principles of Declaration of Independence, laws of nature and God. That this is a quote from them. Laws of nature. He referenced laws of nature and God that endowed every person with the right of liberty. He even went after Van Buren. He went after the president. For knowing the Spain's pro-slavery demands and insisted the case was simple. And this goes back to that very simplicity view of this. Yeah. These African captives were free human beings, kidnapped illegally, who had lawfully defended their freedom.
Yeah.
And on March 9th, 1841, the Supreme Court delivered its decision. A resounding victory for Adams and the Africans. The court ruled that the Amistad captives were not property. They had been held illegal, and they were set free. And in Justice Story, that the previous Supreme Court justice mentioned, affirmed that. And since international slave trade was outlawed, the Africans were victims of kidnapping and had every right to resist. And I just love that.
God, that's such a powerful moment.
Adams walks out of the courtroom, and this is what he said. All he said to the crowds outside was, the captives are free. And Adams would have a string of victories after this before he passed away. He would go on to successfully get the gag rule removed.
Yeah.
It would eventually be defeated by a vote, and it would allow the discussion.
What was the vote on that, the ruling? What was the numbers?
On the Supreme Court ruling?
Yeah.
I believe at this point in time, almost all Supreme Court rulings were unanimous.
Okay.
I believe this was unanimous. And this does predate.
We can shame anybody who voted against.
Shame.
Yeah, more shame.
And it's important to remember, he wasn't arguing this on moral grounds. He won this constitutionally.
Yeah.
And this would be about 7 years for the famous Dred Scott decision, which would that would put the nail in the coffin for we were going to go to war over slavery after Dred Scott. Just to close out Adams' anti-slavery rhetoric, I want to end with a quote from his diary.
Yeah.
He writes in his diary, what can I do for the cause of God and man, for the progress of human emancipation? Yet my conscience presses me on that even when he knew he wasn't going to live to see the end of slavery, he knew that every action he took in that direction would push it one day to the end of slavery. And I just can tell everybody listening, I know Kyle's been very gracious about how much I overly love John Adams. do more homework into this. Go read more on him. Comment below what your favorite John Adams diary quote is, because they are hilarious ones. He Google him and Ben Franklin. Like, just his quotes on Ben Franklin, amazing.
His dad was witty as hell too. I mean, some of the letters from between him and Abigail, I think it was just his response to the "Remember the Ladies." Oh my god,
it's fantastic. He was just like, "Oh, I got another group that doesn't like us." No, there's just, and again, like, I think we did a short on this, the original Bostonians.
Yeah,
they are. They're just sarcastic jerks. And remember, John Adams, they had to pass a law in Congress so he couldn't talk, and his son got a law passed so he couldn't talk in Congress. Gag order. Right.
Well, that's probably about as good a place as any to call it for part one. So join us next week when we, what are we doing next week? What's the... Just kind of threw
we're talking about John. We're going to talk about John Quincy Adams prior to his presidency.
We're going back. Okay, so we're
going back in time. Yeah.
All right. Well, while we're waiting for part two, let us know what you think about our sixth president's character. Is he deserving of all the attention that Eric tries to give him? Should we reformat the show to talk only about the Adams family? Comment or leave us a comment or email below. You can email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. You can visit the website at buckstartsherepodcast.com to stay up to date with everything we've got. We'll see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.